Thanks, Tomasa. I first have to apologize. This was a little bit of a mess up. So I thought I'm going to speak to lensing audience only. So I have quite detailed slides about the method and about the lensing that we are doing, and probably not enough introductory material for all the rest. But I'll try to do favor for both of you and try to accommodate. So if you feel bored or this is getting way too technical at certain point, don't worry. But I'll try to get away, try to get around it. So what I'm going to present today is, as Tomasa said, this particular cluster with a phone number 10657-56. And it's a very interesting merging cluster. And I'll show you in the second part of my talk why it's so interesting and why can we use it the way we think to detect dark matter. But I'll start off with a description of the method that we apply to this cluster. And it's a method for measuring the cluster masses, which combines...
There's a long line out here, so I think we're going to have to move or bring out some chairs. There are chairs in here.
See, while we're waiting for the people, what's the E stand for?
It's an Einstein cluster. It's a cluster sample. It's just astronomers have very weird naming conventions, and those numbers actually stand for the coordinates on the sky. So actually recently I learned it's in a constellation of Carina, if that's of any interest to you, but I didn't know that before, to be honest. Oh my god. I think this would do. All right, so as I said, in the first part of the talk, I'll mostly talk about the method where we combine two types of gravitational lensing in order to measure the cluster mass. And then in the second part, I'll concentrate on this particular cluster and tell you why it's interesting and what can we do with it. So starting off with the clusters, this is a statement which I'm slightly reluctant to put on, but clusters are great tools for cosmology, in principle. Many people here might disagree with that, because if you want to use clusters for cosmology, what you really want to know is a cluster mass. And how to measure cluster mass? Well, astronomers use three main techniques that astronomers use are X-rays, dynamical methods, and gravitational lensing. And so in principle, you should go out, measure the cluster mass with all these three methods, and determine a cluster mass. And one cluster, three methods, same result, question mark. Well, it would be nice if they would all agree, but quite often they don't agree. And there are reasons why they don't agree, which sometimes we know about, sometimes we're kind of puzzled about. But in practice, it doesn't work that nicely. So I particularly developed a method which uses the so-called gravitational lensing in order to do this very precisely and really figure out what is going on in this and other clusters. So I do have an introductory slide on lensing. So what gravitational lensing is, for those of you in the audience who don't know about it, if you have a background source and an intervening clump of matter, in our case, in my case, this is mostly clusters, and then you observe it with HST, what you actually see is not the image of the background source, but because the light is banned due to gravity from this cluster, what you see are multiple images of the same sources. This is what I call strong gravitational lensing. Now, there is also weak gravitational lensing, whereas if source, lens, and your telescope are not on the same optical axis, not so well aligned, if you have a source further out, it's not going to be multiply imaged, but its shape will be slightly distorted. And those light distortion we call weak gravitational lensing. And those can be used also to probe the mass of intervening matter. Now, I know there are a lot of experts on lensing in this audience, so I'm going to ask them a question. What do you think is wrong with this picture? Do I hear anything?
It's not to scale.
This is one thing, but there is something slightly more. Roger, very good. So, yeah, NASA managed to turn their telescope wrong way around. So, yeah, first you have to point your telescope the right way in order to do lensing, and then you can do all the rest. It goes around. Yeah, okay. So the ones who figure out are observers, the ones who didn't figure out are theoreticians. So yes, do we use strong lensing or do we use weak lensing for cluster mass reconstructions? Well, strong lensing sets time constraint on the mass distribution in the very center of the cluster, and it often relies on parameterized models. Whereas weak lensing is in a sense nicer because you can measure the cluster mass along the whole observable field. Now, both of them have their pros and cons. I told you the pros. The cons are probably Mashey degeneracy, which particularly holds for is problematic for weak lensing. You want to extend mass measurements to very small radii, which it's quite difficult to do with weak lensing only. On the other hand, you want to also extend mass measurements to really large radii, because this is important for cosmology. This is what strong lensing has problems with, because it measures the cluster masses in the center. So these all problems that I listed here can be eliminated by doing strong and weak. And doing strong and weak lensing combined is nothing particularly new. And the first idea came from Natarajan and Kneipp. Priya is sitting somewhere in the audience, I thought I saw her. Who've done that in 96, and there were some modifications and additions to it. The particular strength of the method I'm going to describe is that it combines strong and weak lensing in a non-parametric fashion. Non-parametric being in quotes because there are still some parameters involved, but let's say that parameterization is as general as possible. You don't want to assume a profile of the cluster. You don't want to assume that the cluster is isothermal or spherically symmetric, or and you will see why this is important for the bullet cluster I'll be talking about today. In addition, you want to properly include weak lensing constraint in the vicinity where the lens is actually strong, so you don't want to do your first order lensing approximation. There are some complications coming here which need to be taken care of. In addition, what we do is we include redshift information for strong and weak lensing sources, which helps breaking the Mashey degeneracy. Now, I don't want to go into Mashey degeneracy too much because it's a very detailed thing, but let's just say that if you measure the mass distribution from traditional lensing method, what you get is surface mass density map. And if you scale the surface mass density map, you would still equally well reproduce the lensing constraints, but your mass is going to be completely different. And in order to break this degeneracy, you need to include redshift information. And if anybody is interested in details, I can talk about it. So this is now getting very technical. For those of you who are not lensing experts, you can fall asleep for the next couple of slides. But the method I'm using is following the idea of Bartleman et al. And we don't parameterize our cluster mass distribution on a grid, but we don't put mass as free parameter on a grid. We rather use the values of the potential. The reason why we do that is because every lensing observable is locally dependent upon that potential. And then having this potential values on a grid, what we do is we write down this chi-square, which is a simple chi-square, which includes weak lensing, strong lensing, and there is a regularization term which needs to enter because weak lensing data is very noisy. So if you feed very noisy data with number of parameters which is large, what is going to happen is the reconstruction will tend to overfit the noise. So basically, it will produce sharp peaks so as to fit every single noisy estimate of whatever you want to measure. And so you get this jagged structure mass distribution which is unphysical. So this kind of says, oh, we believe that the mass distribution is relatively smooth on a certain scale. This is what this regularization parameter does. And then this is a chi-square, which is a function of all your parameters on a grid. And this is a number which easily exceeds 100. And so minimizing a function with 100 free parameters is, as you probably have all experienced in the past, quite difficult. So the way we proceed is we start from some trial solution, because this is also non-linear, non-quadratic function of potential. And as a result, this is a non-linear function of a potential. So we linearize it and iteratively solve this equation, which is del chi square over del psi equals 0. Now, inverting a huge matrix is not necessarily simpler than minimizing a chi-square, but it turns out that this matrix is actually sparse. So there are very good methods on the web which you can use in order to solve this system of sparse system of equation. And then, as I said, you do a trial solution from strong lensing, and you can, by the end of the day, using your potential, you can predict the quantities of interest. Now, I really apologize, I didn't put any of the definitions on, because I really did assume it's going to be only interesting for lensing people. So kappa is the surface mass density, gamma is the shear, and alpha is deflection angle. And they all depend upon the mass and the mass distribution. And these are the quantities we can measure with our data. And so by measuring these quantities, we can actually infer what's the mass of the cluster, but not just what's the total mass of the cluster, also how the mass is distributed, and what's the profile, and things like that. So the method works, and the reason why we think it works is that here is a simulation of a realistic cluster from Volker Springer, and what you see here is the surface mass density map. So what Lensing measures is not a three-dimensional mass distribution, but it rather measures the projected density. So imagine your three-dimensional cluster, you squash it along the line of sight, and this is what Lensing measures. And this is what is represented here in color. There is one multiple image system I simulated here. These are those four stars. And we use this data, we simulate the weak and strong Lensing data, and try to reconstruct this mass distribution. Doing it with the data we get from ground-based telescopes, you can see that the reconstruction represents fairly well the mass distribution on this side. What is quite astonishing is that we also get the scaling right. So this means we did break the Masher degeneracy. Going further to space-based data, it's getting even better. It's the other way around. This is the simulation, this is the reconstruction. Taking more multiple image systems, you can start to reconstruct the little clumps as well. So,
is the primary difference there in the resolution or the sensitivity?
The primary difference is in resolution. That means how many weak Lensing galaxies can you measure from space, and how many multiple image systems can you identify when you take a space-based data. Lots of the arcs are really thin. So when you convolve this with a ground-based PSF, they get kind of blurred out, and you cannot really tell whether these are arcs or not sometimes. So that's the main difference. It's also much easier to identify if you have two images of the same source. It's not only, you know that the color needs to be conserved. So if you have two blue smudges, it's increasingly simpler if you actually can take morphology into account. So what would look from ground like two blobs actually does have some sort of morphology in ACS, and you can more, you can identify these to be multiple images of the same source. So it gets easier and better. Now, sorry about this introduction, but so up to now, all I basically you need to remember is we have a method, we combine strong and weak lensing, and we can measure the mass reconstruction in a cluster. The bullet cluster, 1EO657-56, is particularly interesting because it's one of the hottest and the most X-ray luminous clusters known. And it's also a unique case of a supersonic cluster merger. So it's a merger occurring nearly in a plane in the sky, and the reason we know that is from the X-ray data. So this is a half a megasecond Chandra data. When I first heard this half a megasecond number, I said, wow, but Tommaso claims this is just regular stuff. So the cluster got its nickname bullet cluster because of this bullet type shape. So this is the X-ray. What you see here in emission is a gas. And what you see is two chunks of gas, one here and one here. And basically, when you look, basically what happened with this cluster is, in the past, there were two big clusters that merged together, smashed through each other, and are now flying away from each other. And this is the shock front, and this is the bullet. So, using this gas density jump at a shock, you can derive the Mach number of this shock, which is 3.2, which is the highest Mach number in a cluster known so far. And this corresponds to a subcluster velocity of 4,500 kilometers a second, which is a huge velocity. So basically, those two lumps of material smashed together and are now flying away from each other with relative velocity of 4,500 kilometers a second. People have claimed that this is unphysical, and we had to measure this velocity wrong. But in fact, if you go look in the simulations, yes, this is a relatively high velocity because it's above escape velocity you would expect for such a system. So how rare is the bullet cluster? Well, it is rare, but it doesn't seem to be exceptionally rare. So it's not like it contradicts lambda CDM or something. The peak of the density is offset from cluster galaxies, is offset from X-ray at 3.4 sigma significance. I'll explain this in a moment. And in addition, you want to ask what's where the dark matter is. So what does your grandmother's gravity has to say about this system? So taking the standard gravity into account, and Hongsheng Zhao will argue for this system what happens if you don't. But let me go ahead with our regular gravitational law and explain you this system. So what you see here in the red are the same gas mass density that you saw inferred from the image you saw in the previous plot. And what you see in blue is the total matter. This is the work from Douglas Kloe, who is going to talk on a conference next week. And he's going to present you this data in particular, so I don't want to go into detail. But this was using weak lensing only. You can determine where most of the mass is. And you see that most of the mass is not where most of the galaxies are, where most of the gas is. Now, galaxies, which you see here, these are all the cluster members. They are coincident with the total mass rather than the total galaxy component. So now, if I draw on a board a picture what happened to these systems. So we had two clusters beforehand. They all had galaxies inside, and they had gas inside. Whoop. Let's not do that. And they basically smashed together. So what happened then is, this is the after picture. We have galaxies here, dark matter here. We have galaxies here, dark matter here. But the gas, because of the ram pressure stripping, kind of stays in between. And these two are flying away from each other with relative velocity of 4,500 kilometers a second. So, to put this into a really rough, so I went to a student of ours, people who do visualization in our group, and asked them to produce a movie for me of what had happened. And I literally asked the student just to, you know, collide blobs, nothing physical. And this John Wise, in a night, actually managed to get a full-blown simulation of this cluster. But keep in mind that, you know, he just played with the parameters such that that it looks okay in the image. Now, oh, this is later, and it's actually working. So what you see in this image is blue is the dark matter, and red is the gas. And as those two clusters collide, dark matter, because it's relatively collisionless, is flying straight through. And gas, which is behaves like a liquid, has been ram pressure stripped, and it's staying in between the two. So in the end, what you see is dark matter versus gas. And this is what happens if you let the simulation run a little bit further. So this is a full-blown N-body plus hydrodynamical simulation, though the parameters he chosen might not be fully representative of that system. But this is a schematic view of what is happening with this cluster. Again, two lumps of dark matter plus gas colliding. Gas being stripped is left behind. Dark matter flies through. Now imagine dark matter being fluid-like. If you imagine dark matter being fluid-like, it's going to stay at exactly the same place where the gas is. So already this picture tells us that dark matter has to be relatively collisionless. Okay. Okay. I never used movies before, so I'm really scared about that one. So how do we know, as I said, weak lensing only, what is represented here is the observation of the bullet cluster, and overlaid in contours is the surface mass density from weak lensing alone first. And what you see, yes, dark matter, well, I have to say total matter is clearly concentrated on the galaxies. And I'll show in a second, clearly offset from the gas. If you combine weak and strong lensing data, what you get is a lot much better resolution and also higher significance of the offset. So what I show here is when you combine weak and strong lensing data, you clearly start to resolve these small clumps. You resolve the gas, this is the position of the gas, so you kind of get a better idea of what's the shape of the dark matter potential and the total matter potential that this cluster resides in. Overlaying here are now the X-ray contours in yellow, and what you see is this is the total gas distribution. It's clearly offset from the total matter distribution. So the picture is consistent with what you saw in a simple movie I showed you before. In numbers, well, so if you look at a projected enclosed mass, what we see is that within 250 kiloparsecs, you get something like 3 × 10⁴ solar masses and 2 × 10⁴ solar masses for the main cluster and the subcluster, which if you assume an isothermal profile would mean a velocity dispersion of 1400 and 1200. Now, assuming an isothermal profile in this system, I wouldn't do it at all, because the system has gone under such violent merger that we don't really expect it to be isothermal at the stage we observe it. But this is just the numbers for reference. You can measure the profile as well, which I plotted here. However, the constraints are not, don't start asking me whether I believe in NFW or not right now, because the constraints are not really that great yet to be able to really distinguish between N of 1.5 or N of 1. So, yes, where have all the baryons gone? Again, this is just a schematic representation. This is where most of the baryons are. This is where all the gas resides. I forgot to tell you that in clusters, most of the luminous matter is in a form of a hot gas. So cluster galaxies make only a tiny bit of a makeup of the system. So it's mostly in a gas, and this is the center of the gas. And these are 1 sigma contours of the positions of the total mass peaks, which you see here. And these are the position of the two brightest cluster members. So you see those two things are clearly offset, and they're offset by 10 and 6 sigma significance. Dark matter properties. I told you before that we can actually measure dark matter properties using this cluster. How do we do that? It's already the fact that dark matter does not behave like a fluid, which we see that we can say, oh, dark matter must be collisionless, relatively collisionless. And we can actually put some constraint on it. So when you combine Chandra data with Lenzing mass maps, you can place an upper bound on dark matter self-interaction cross-section. So this is how dark matter will interact with itself, dark matter particle, which is sigma over m of 1 centimeter square per gram, which tells something to astronomers, because this limit, actually, there were claims that dark matter must be self-interacting in order to explain the missing satellite problems, but the type of cross-sections that was required was few centimeters squares per gram. For the particle physicist, this is approximately half a barn per GeV to convert in your units. The limits are very high, so this is not a type of a limit you would want to achieve, which is more in a picobarn regimes. As I said, this is the first measurement, and so it is very interesting for astrophysical application, and it's getting there also for particle physics application. We are going to improve on that limits, because this is only using the old data. We are now doing the full-blown simulations to improve on those limits. So they come from three different reasoning. One is, the significant offset between subcluster X-ray gas core and dark matter peaks. Another one is survival of the subcluster dark matter peak during interaction. Because if you would have dark matter which would be interacting, the peaks of dark matter, when they would collide, would get really fuzzy. So they wouldn't remain as peaky as they are, as we observe them. No loss of mass from subcluster during interaction gives additional constraint. This is just, we look at the mass-to-light ratio of the subcluster, and we see that it's fairly consistent with a regular cluster. So there cannot be much mass loss that happened for that subcluster. Gas fractions. This is also an interesting thing. This is the plot that confused a lot of people in the past, so I hope I'll do a better job in explaining it. What I plot here are 4 different regions, and in each region, what we've done is we measured the total gas mass, and we measured the total mass, and we took the ratio. Nothing more sophisticated than that. And what you get, that the gas to total mass ratio is 0.2 in the regions where you have most of the gas, but it's 0.09 and 0.04 in the other two regions. So those two clusters have had a gas loss, meaning gas had to go somewhere else, and it's actually here. Because the regular number for the clusters is more like 0.14. This is also consistent with what we see in the whole observable field. So, is it really evidence for dark matter? I think it is. But there were claims, and Hongsheng is going to discuss all about them, that if you adopt what Paul Schechter would call not your grandmother's gravity, What you can do is, using these modified theories of gravity, you can actually fit the weak Lansing kappa contours. And the way you fit them is you have to adopt gas in your system. Clearly, we observe it, it's there. And however, you do have to have a form of a matter that's not visible. And Hongsheng is going to talk all about it. But it's actually 2 eV neutrinos. If you assume your non-visible matter to be 2 eV neutrinos, you can explain the system without the need of using dark matter.
How much? How many neutrinos do you need? Is it consistent with the limits from CMB and so on?
So the first problem is neutrinos are fermions, so you cannot really pack them as much as you can. That's why you need 2 eV rather than the regular half or even less. If they're consistent with Hongsheng?
Sorry?
Consistent with CMB experiments, neutrinos?
The limit would be like 0.7 eV if you want to use GR plus neutrino to explain WMAP data. But if you want to do some other things, then the limit is different.
Yeah. Also, the gas mass you guys adopted seemed to be factor of 2 with the gas mass that Chandra people claim to observe. We should go into discussion after that. But another paper is Moffat in 2006, where also he also uses modified gravity theory to displace kappa peaks away from the gas peaks. However, he does not adopt any sort of invisible matter, but what they get is a very unphysical profile. So they get a profile which is actually as a function of radius, which is surface mass density rising, and rising all the way to the edge of the observable field, which is something we just don't observe in clusters. All clusters have a falling...
So for the larger field, maybe that theory would go away.
Well, we do have field as large, you know, we do have wide field imager field, so, and we do see declining mass profile. I mean, this is something very, very standard for clusters. So, yes, there are ways around it. I'm not claiming this is the end of the story, but I hope I did convince you that, yes, the bullet cluster poses a serious challenge for modified gravity theories. And so, conclusions. Well, strong and weak Lansing together are really good in terms of determining the mass of the cluster and also where the cluster mass is and what's associated with. It's very powerful to constrain mass distribution in the course of the clusters, especially for the clusters where standard parameterized modeling fails. This is especially disturbed cluster, the one we observe here, and there are many other examples that we know of. We have obtained the tight constraints on mass distribution. Most of the matter is not where most of the baryons are. And in addition, this is more astrophysical thing as well as particle physics thing. It's a unique cluster merger system. So we can combine all possible data set, and we by far didn't explore everything yet. There is a lot more to be learned from this cluster. There are better constraints on dark matter self-interaction cross-section to be done. There is very interesting gas physics going on. You have these huge temperatures going on in this cluster. Cluster dynamics, merger history, galaxy formation and evolution. You name it, probably you can do it. So my conclusion is, yes, gravitational lensing is truly golden for this very golden lens.
So what we should do now is, if you have questions just for Marisa, ask them, like if there's something you don't understand or you'd like more explanation. So she can take a few questions and then we can move on to Hongsheng. that we need to do the discussion on alternative interpretations of this result.
Yeah. I mean, just help me put this in context. I guess the real excitement here is that you see the lensing in a region away from where most of the baryons are.
Yeah.
But people who do weak lensing and try to map the dark matter, I mean, haven't they already seen sort of regions of dark matter where there's no obvious or ordinary matter? Or?
No. There was a claim that they saw a purely dark clusters,
dark cluster, yeah.
But this kind of went away, so it might have been a statistical fluke. So it's still unresolved issue whether that's real cluster or not. There was a claim there was a 3 sigma significant detection, which is low for lensing. 3 sigma significant detection on a mass peak is fairly low. And then going, this was from the ground-based data, space-based data were taken and the significance went down. So it might be there, but it's not a clear-cut example. In addition, when you go to regular clusters, what you do have is always the geometry of this system is just fantastic. It's a plane in the sky, right? Imagine this system you saw in a movie when it turns around. So if it's turned around that way, all you see is things piled on top of each other. So it's a less clear evidence that there must be something more than dark matter, something more than just a visible matter.
Recording masses for the central 250 kilopascals.
Yeah.
Cluster must be much bigger.
Cluster is much bigger.
So what's the total mass in the dark matter, and what's the total mass in the gas?
So the only thing I can say from my data is what you saw on that one slide. And the reason is, this is our observable field, and we can only measure the mass on the field that we observe with my method. Douglas Clough, and this is the ratio, it's the 0.14, and the total mass, I think it's 10 to the 15 is the dark matter in the hole in this. But you have to imagine this as a cylinder, as a like box projected. Right. This is not necessarily a mass estimate you want to do cosmology with. But so if you want to do cosmology, you have to go beyond this observable field. And Douglas Clough is going to talk next week about a weak lensing observation where he uses Magellan data so he can push it to larger radii. In principle, there is no limitations to apply my method to larger radii. In practice, the limitation is we would need to improve the methods to change the pixel scale. So you want to have small pixels where you have strong lensing, and you want to have big pixels where you have less signal-to-noise data, which comes from weak lensing on those large radii. And this is something that hasn't been done yet. I'm currently working on it, but it's numerically really difficult.
See, the reason for asking the question was, for 10 to 15 solar mass clusters, you expect so
the
collision velocity to 3,000
kilometers a second. Exactly.
So the question is, who generates that extra velocity?
This is something, so as I said, 4,500 was big, and that's why Eric Hayashi went to look in the simulations, what are the velocity distribution. So he went to Millennium Run and looked what are the velocity distributions of substructures in a bigger clusters. And yeah, you can occasionally have larger velocities than escape velocity, and this will still be gravitationally bound system. So for example, if you have a substructure in a highly elliptical orbit, you can get occasionally velocities which are a lot higher than escape velocity. But this is something that needs to be carefully simulated. And we are working on it to really figure out what is going on.
Do you have any observation about the environment of this cluster? I mean, very large scale environment.
Yeah, this
very, very large, filaments or something like that. Because if that were the case, you might expect the velocity.
If it's flying along the filament. Also, if you look at so on the larger scales, there doesn't seem to be anything striking, which doesn't mean it's not there. I mean, just if you look in the colors. You see a couple of clumps of galaxies with the same color, but nothing really jumps out. However, if you look at all these cluster members, so these are all cluster members. So this is clearly elongated. You also see this in mass distribution. So, you know, thinking in terms of two spherical blobs colliding is probably wrong. So you have to take into account this elliptical distribution and then try to model the dynamics of an extra infalling clump and simulate this merger properly to really see what caused this high velocity.
But people who look at samples of relaxed clusters claim that they measure that the gas fractions are back, it's pretty constant. This is, albeit probably pretty extreme cases, you'd be the main to point out.
But this is, if you go to this scale of this observable field, this is not that large, right? You get the fairly regular gas mass fraction.
Aren't you worried when you assemble those clusters out of many collisions like this, you'll get inhomogeneities in the ratio of gas? I mean, people are trying to use that method with fairly high precision to do cosmography.
Sure. I mean, I do worry a little, although, to be honest, I mean, it's mostly happening on these smaller scales. So if you go out to large enough radii, you should be able, you know, the gas is not being expelled out in huge amounts. So it's still there.
It's right, still close to the omega b divided omega n fraction, the total.
Yeah, but I wouldn't use this cluster to do any sort of precision gas to total mass.
No, but the big relaxed ones were like this, perhaps like this in the past as they were being assembled.
Yeah.
One worries about what is left over as the sort of vestigial evidence for their relics of, sorry, their assembly.
The kinds of clusters that Steve Allen has been using, they don't see any displacement in the center of mass, the donor mass, and the X-ray gas. So they are making a pretty careful selection. So even if they've assembled violently, they've had time to settle down.
Are you worried that the gas would be expelled from the system?
No, I'm just worried that it would be kind of inhomogeneous. And
but as long as you take it all together, you still measure it all.
That's undoubtedly true, a certain level of precision. But as you try and push this to higher and higher precision to do cosmography, the effects of the buildup with two positions like this.
What I worry about, for example, if you see this one in this dynamical state, but then rotate it such that you see it along the line of sight, what you would see in X-rays is probably fairly round cloud of gas. So when you try to model this and determine the gas mass, you might be wrong in determining the gas mass. So this is the part I do worry, but this is very extreme example, so. Most of the clusters, well, not the ones lensing people really care about, but lots of them are relaxed.
So if there are no more questions, then we can move on to our discussion leader function. Okay, so we'll do a little